Jesus was a hit. He was the new phenomenon in Galilee, and the locals were proud of their boy. Then in Luke 4, he comes home to Nazareth, and he reads to them from 2 Isaiah. Full of expectation, the hometown crowd encouraged him to explain the text. They wanted to hear how he would cure their poverty, their blindness, and their oppression. Well, in the part that we didn't read this morning, Jesus doesn't explain the text, but he does mightily peeve them off, so much so that they form themselves into a lynch mob and try to kill him. Jesus describes himself to them as a prophet, but like Elijah, who, though there were many poor in Israel, helped only the widow in Sidon. And like Elijah, who, though there were many lepers in Israel, helped only Naaman the Syrian. The hometown crowd were enraged. How dare he be a prophet for outcasts and Gentiles, but not for them? How dare he assume that those who nurtured him in the faith were not worthy of his ministry? How dare the locus of his ministry be directed towards those who did not obey, who were outside the God-given laws of religion? The reading itself from the scriptures was not offensive, just as most Christians don't find the Bible offensive. It was rather the choice Jesus made about the direction that his ministry would take that gave offense. Jesus was not a focus of unity. He was not kind and considerate of everyone. He wouldn't have made a good bishop, and nobody righteous would have elected him. Now, if Jesus had a good PR advisor, he could have done the whole preaching in the Nazareth synagogue very differently. He could have begun by saying that God loved everybody, you, me, them, and God had chosen people for various specific tasks. If it had been written by then, which of course it wasn't, he could have used that lovely reading from St. Paul about us all belonging to one another in the one body. He could have helped them see that he was their expression, their ambassador of God's love to others. He could have worked them round so they could have all ended up affirming each other and had a nice group hug. Instead, he got them offside, big time. Like prophets of the past, he wasn't much of a crowd pleaser. He failed diplomacy school. I was sent to Anglican diplomacy school back in 1982. Yet it was then a school that had recently disregarded the church's subservience to unity and had embarked on a different path. For some 5 months before I started, the Springbok rugby team had toured New Zealand and met with fierce opposition. The country was divided, so too the church. St. John's College, read diplomacy school, due to the actions of a number of staff and students, was clearly seen as aligned with the anti-apartheid movement. The college suffered an arson attempt, and some members were beaten. In the church, there were those who were opposed to the tour due to their desire to see the end of apartheid. There were those opposed to the tour due to the visions it was creating in New Zealand. And there were those supportive of the tour due to their belief and support being non-political. While many opposed racist tours, including many in this Church of St. Matthew, I'd be surprised if they were the majority. My guess is that the overwhelming rejection of the government's pro-tour stance by the church was due to the divisions being exposed. The church has a long history of being opposed to anything that exposes or creates division. Mostly it favors unity before justice. I therefore arrived at Theological College in the aftermath of one of the most visible, contentious political protests this country has known. The priority of unity in the church and nation seemed to have temporarily taken a back seat to justice for blacks in South Africa. It was quite extraordinary. In 1982, Maori land rights was the pertinent issue of the college. There was no Waitangi tribunal, no legislation that enabled judicial assessment of past injustices back to 1840, and there was plenty of fear and prejudice. Bastion Point was still very much an alive issue. The settlement with Ngāti Whātua o Ōraki that we know today, the benefits not only the local iwi, but the public of Auckland with a wonderful green area, was a long way off. The so-called celebrations at Waitangi were also a strong point of contention. Each year, the government tried to promulgate the myth that we were all one people, while ignoring past injustices. Dignitaries gathered, the Navy and the band were there, and a church service was held. Each year, protesters gathered to refute the government's position, and many Christians joined these protests. In 1983, nine Christians were arrested for disrupting the Waitangi church service. The circumstances seem almost comic today. An Anglican cleric supportive of the government and believing in the importance of unity was primed to lead the outdoor service. Police lined up shoulder to shoulder down the pews, looking for dissidents. Two young people, one of whom was Maori, were escorted out before the service began on the suspicion that they might have been there to cause trouble. All they'd done was sit and pray. At 3 minutes to the hour, a group of six European clerics and laity stood up and began leading the service along the theme of repentance. The flustered government-approved minister blubbered and directed the police, who led the six away. Later, another unapproved cleric, Father Terry Dibble, got up during the intercessions and offered a non-approved prayer. He too was arrested for praying. As were two theological students who had sackcloth under their clothes and sprinkled their heads with ash. I was one of them. The weeks that follow provided a useful insight into the church. While official church statements had promoted justice for Māori, the arrest of the nine brought harsh condemnation from many religious quarters. It was as if the nine had created division in society. We were labeled anarchists, destructive of the unitive fabric of the nation. Church unity. Church unity is a byproduct of following Jesus. When people work together, pray together, and suffer together for a common vision, then bonds are inevitably built. The vision comes first, then the commitment, then the actions, a consequence being the building of unity. When bishops, cathedrals, or clergy begin to describe their key task as building unity, then alarm bells start to go off in my head. Unity has taken the place of vision, and even worse, unity has become the vision. Not so long ago, a dean told me he wasn't prepared to offer blessings to gay and lesbian couples because of his cathedral's role in the unity of the diocese. He wasn't prepared to act without the agreement of the whole diocese. Bishops have told me the same thing, unprepared to act without the collegiality of the whole House of Bishops. And the whole House of Bishops have said the same thing. They're not prepared to act without the collegiality of all the other bishops in the Anglican world. A favorite verse of those who don't want to do anything offensive is from 1 Corinthians, where Paul talks deprecatingly about causing a brother or sister to stumble. In this thinking, a conservative minority can stall or prevent any change. Bishop Jack Spong has for a long time been one critical of the church's overemphasis on unity. He says the priority of unity often supersedes the priority of truth. Truth, however, can be a fickle thing, and the basis for determining truth controversial. There are Christians, for example, who believe the biblical truth condemns homosexual relationships. Others, such as me, would argue the Bible is silent on committed relationships between same-sex partners. And further, the Jesus movement was supportive of people and relationships outside of the heterosexual norm. Using the Bible, therefore, as the sole standard for truth is problematic. The wisdom, experience, and reasoning of the community is necessary. Yet still, what is truth is not easily arrived at. It usually requires a choice to prioritize one or more values over others. Regarding same-sex relationships, for example, I prioritize the rights of a minority to enter into mutual loving relationships over the dominant tradition within Christianity of disparaging such relationships. I would submit that to follow in the footsteps of Jesus, one has to make choices. Choices that have the strong possibility of putting one offside with the majority. Too often, Christian leadership sees itself as maintaining the best of the past, being sensitive to the needs of all people, and being resistant to any change that will alienate support. And this is the type of leadership that the institution affirms. It's said to be a caring, doesn't offend people. The altar of unity is very seductive. There are, however, a number of Christians and Christian leaders who walk a different, less trod path. They have chosen to turn their back on the vision of unity, and instead, knowing their actions will be offensive, stand with the unpopular, the foreign, and the despised. The marginal are prioritized, not the mainstream. Many of the priests and laity of this parish of St. Matthew's have trod that path, and I too am proud to try and follow their examples.